Division 2 of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for oral argument this afternoon. The first is People v. Perez. Looks like counsel are present and ready. Second case is Hannon Law Firm v. Millat, Pressman and Higby. Counsel present and ready in that case?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very well. We'll take that case second. Let me just reiterate briefly for those of you who may not have argued here recently that these cases are set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system at the podium, which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light comes on. And when the full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on. Appellant may reserve whatever time you wished for rebuttal. If you want me to help you with that, I will do so. However, there is a timing clock on the podium, which counts backwards. So that will tell you how much time you have left in your argument. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument and skip recitation of the facts, that's fine with us. However, the case is yours to argue as you wish. Please feel free to adjust the podium upwards and downwards. There's a toggle switch for that purpose. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please, because we're recording your arguments, and if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. Please also be aware that your arguments are available over the internet within a day or two following today's date. So if there is confidential information that you wish not to broadcast, be guided accordingly. Finally, if anyone has a cell phone or other paging device in the courtroom this morning, or this afternoon rather, please turn it off at this time. We're ready for argument, Mr. Carberry.
May it please the court. Tom Carberry appearing for Mr. Perez. I'd like to address the two juror issues briefly, if I may. Apparently, all the trials in Greeley, Colorado now are done to anonymous jurors. This is the only jurisdiction that I know of in Colorado that does this. And as the briefs lay out, all the federal courts that have addressed this issue have said that anonymous juries burden the presumption of innocence, and that the federal courts have developed a two-part test. And basically, it's the test from People Against Thomas, a 1985 Second Circuit case, saying that the judge has to have a strong reason to believe there's a problem, that the jurors need protection. And then the judge must make some efforts to minimize what happened here. But that's not what happened in this case. What happened in this case is that the trial judge told the lawyers that he has been doing this in every case for the last 20 cases. Now, the problem with that, as the trial defense counsel pointed out, is that it makes the defendant look like he's a dangerous person to the jurors. And that was the perfect objection, because that's exactly what the federal courts and the Massachusetts Supreme Court have also held the same thing. Here, the trial judge did not do any of these balancing factors. And that violated Mr. Perez's rights, because this case was a pure credibility case.
Mr. Carberry, was there any indication in the record that the trial judge told the jurors that it was his practice to do this in all of his cases?
I do not remember the trial judge doing that. He did tell the jurors that he was going to do that. He elaborated it more, Judge Terry, with the lawyers themselves. But even then, that's the second prong of the Thomas test, to try to minimize the effect on the jurors. But the first prong is there must be some danger to the jurors. And as the brief points out, these jurors are not nincompoops. These jurors know that the reason their names aren't given out is there's something wrong.
Well, I'm having a hard time understanding why this would be considered an anonymous jury when the counsel and the defendant had access to their names, addresses, and their questionnaires.
There's no evidence that the defendant had access to any of that.
Counsel did.
Counsel did, but that's not the point. The point is, Judge Terry.
Well, if counsel did, didn't defendant then have access to it as well by necessity?
No, absolutely not.
No court order that defendant could not be aware of that information, was there?
There's nothing in the record to indicate that the defendant knew anybody's names, nothing.
But if it had the effect on jurors, the juror questionnaire gave their name, occupation, number of children, ages, et cetera, how would that have an effect on them that this is not, that this would have some prejudicial impact? I'm not following.
Well, Judge Furman, it's because of this. Because the jurors know that the lawyers get the juror questionnaires and the judge gets the juror questionnaires, but the way it appeared in the record is that the jurors believed that the defendant did not know their name. And that's the evil that the federal courts don't allow, because you cannot have anonymous jurors, because the reason the jurors will think that Mr. Perez is a dangerous person and he and his associates would come to their homes and harm their families and themselves. That's the issue that the federal courts have all addressed in the Massachusetts Supreme Court. We can't have a situation where Colorado decides to divorce itself from the rest of the United States and say that the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply, that we can all of a sudden say we're going to have a unanimous jurors in every case. That's
anonymous?
Anonymous. Anonymous jurors in every case. That's just, that cannot pass federal constitutional muster. And what we're looking at here is having dozens, if not hundreds, of cases reversed by the federal courts. That will happen one day, because that is going to happen. Somebody will go to the federal courts. Many people will go to the federal courts, because this has only started, so nobody is time barred. And all of a sudden, you're going to have to retry it at the cost of the judiciary. For all of these cases, this is a very dangerous practice that the trial judges in Greeley have enacted, and it's time for this court needs to realize that the United States Constitution, in the Sixth Amendment, requires public trials, and as the U.S. Supreme Court cases have noted, that goes back for hundreds and hundreds of years, long before the right to counsel. Always have been public trials. The names of the jurors have always been known.
And well, let me just follow up, I guess, with this juror questionnaire, because I've got a sample one in front of me, because this is what the jurors were told. So it's hard for me to understand, again, the anonymous piece. This information will remain confidential and will be known only by the court and the parties to this case. So if the defendant is a party to the case, the jurors are told this will be known.
Only if they assume that the defendant is the party and not the lawyers. It
just says parties to the case.
I know, but what you're saying here is because we're going to do it that way, that all of a sudden we can just ignore federal law. There, you know, this court.
Well, in the cases that you rely on in the briefs, this was not communicated. Is that not correct? Those were racketeering cases where there was witness intimidation, et cetera, and these jury questionnaires were not given over to anybody.
They were all narcotics cases.
Right.
It's another part of what the war on drugs is doing to the federal constitution, diminishing it. And that's, here we have jurors who are saying that, are being told that we're not going to let your names out. Well, who are they keeping the names from but the defendant? What other person in the courtroom needs to have their names taken away from them? Only the defendant. That doesn't make any sense. The people in the audience don't get know their names. It's probably the jurors' families in the audience. That doesn't make any sense. And I'd also like to return to the issue of juror number 16. Juror number 16 said all the things that the Colorado Supreme Court for decades has said a juror can't say. She said at least twice that she had a serious doubt that she could, whether she could be fair or not. In Naylor against Siepel, that's a 1980 case, and that's been affirmed over and over again by Court of Appeals cases. A juror can't say that. She equivocated over and over and over again, and nobody rehabilitated her.
Well, is that still good law under federal constitutional guidelines? Ross versus Oklahoma, Martinez Salazar?
I think
the McCrander rule, is that still good law?
It's all good Colorado law. Colorado jury selection law is much better than federal law.
I thought McCrander was based on federal law.
McCrander is different than federal law in a lot of ways, because McCrander keeps Colorado's position of automatic reversal if a challenge for cause is incorrect. In the federal courts, you don't get automatic reversal.
Ross rejected that approach.
Yeah, but in Colorado, you still do get automatic reversal under the Colorado Supreme Court. So our law still remains much better than federal law. And here are juror number 16, whose name was discussed just like that, through her entire colloquy, indicated that she could not be fair because of her cross-examination in a prior case. And just on that, but here we have two juror issues, and Mr. Paris got an enormously long sentence for a man who always worked and had no significant background of criminal history at all, and got convicted of a class 2 felony and will never get out of prison. And he got that with an anonymous jury and with a voir dire that was conducted in a way that violates Colorado law. And for those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I think I'll start with the anonymous jury issue. And there are five strong reasons among others that this jury did not prejudice the defendant and that anonymous juries as a whole should be allowed in the manner they are up in Greeley. The first one is that this jury was just not anonymous, and both Your Honor Judge Terry and Your Honor Judge Furman pointed that out, that counsel knew their names. They filled out the juror questionnaires prior to arriving to the jury assembly room, and they filled out additional questionnaires that they knew were going directly to counsel and to the parties once they got into the jury room, with their names, their addresses, their marital status, their jobs, and additional case-specific information. So there's no reason to think, other than pure speculation, that the juror questionnaires would have done anything besides go directly to the parties. The second reason is that the trial court issued several instructions to this jury that effectively told the jury, one, you still have to give the defendant his presumption of innocence, you still have to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and especially, he said, this is my practice, this is how I impanel juries, and I do it to protect your privacy interests, and that's on page 413 of the record. He says it very specifically to the jury, and that also is automatically going to mitigate any sort of prejudice that the defendant is going to receive, and make anything that the defendant and anything that's been offered to this court so far pure speculation.
What did he mean when he said privacy interests? That's a little bit vague to me.
Sure. What I mean, and what the judge appears to have meant, is that privacy from the media, to keep their names out, to keep them from being discussed in the papers, to keep them from being approached while they're on the panel. There was actually a very recent article in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago talking about this anonymous jury issue in terms of the former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's trial, who was also impaneled an anonymous jury. One notably not having anything to do with the war on drugs, because with the modern media and internet and Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, it's incredibly easy to contact jurors, and it's incredibly easy for outside parties to try to influence the case. And that's just a pure privacy issue, totally apart from safety. The third reason that I wanted to discuss.
Would a reasonable juror apprehend that to be the case, if they're told that it's to protect your privacy interests?
I believe so, and there are two reasons I believe so for that. One, that's what they're explicitly being told by the judge. The judge is not saying this defendant is particularly villainous. The judge is saying this defendant or this trial has the potential to gain a lot of media attention, and indeed in this case, a very basic Google search of the defendant's name and even just the city yields 3 hits on articles. Or possibly more. And the second reason is that part of the whole staple of criminal law is that when a judge issues an instruction to a jury, it is presumed that jury believes that instruction. It's not presumed that the jury disbelieves it. That flies in the face of the entire jury system. So the judge saying, we're issuing this because this is the common practice and to protect your privacy, is something that the jurors are assumed to believe. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carberry talked briefly about the criteria under the federal courts and suggested that the criteria there was exclusive, exhaustive, and non-applicable here. And in all those instances, he's incorrect. They're not exclusive. As we talked about the privacy issue and the common practice issue. And here we have three discussions, three of the criteria from the federal court that are applicable here. One is the privacy issue based on potential media attention. Two, the federal courts explicitly say the more severe the crime, the more likely or the more permissible an anonymous jury is. But they don't say that if a crime is not severe, that it's not appropriate. And they also say that the length of a sentence has a huge impact as well on the anonymous jury issue. And here we have a very severe crime where two people, the defendant and his co-defendant, held down a woman and physically assaulted and raped her. And he, as a result, faced an extended prison term of, I believe he was 24 years to life. So both of those factors are met here as well. Additionally, a few of the federal courts cases, United States versus Scarfo being one of them, explicitly said that where this is true, even in celebrated cases such as RICO cases, like the federal court cases that predominantly discuss this issue, where it's true in these sort of cases, it's equally true in less celebrated cases. So the fact that it's a quote unquote less celebrated case, which is debatable to begin with, doesn't necessarily become a deal breaker for this. The fourth thing, and I think this is interesting, and it's a subtext that runs through a lot of the federal cases, is that any effective anonymous jury is just as likely to have benefited the defendant, because if the jury is to believe that the defendant doesn't know his name, and that's not the case here, as we know, but if a jury believes that they're truly anonymous, they are more likely to render an impartial verdict, because they are not going to be worrying about the defendant tracking them down or trying to meddle with them and their families post-verdict. They're willing to act on the courage of their convictions, to coin a phrase. And the fifth reason I think that's relevant here is that even if all that doesn't matter, even if we have a huge trial court error, which in no way, shape, or form is under the facts here, it's absolutely harmless. And the reason we have that is because we have a great deal of evidence and testimony against this defendant. And more importantly, the defendant hasn't demonstrated any degree of actual prejudice. And under a Holbrook, that's what the defendant has to do. He has to show that there was actual prejudice going on that deprived him of a fair trial. Here we have, to backtrack a little bit, the trial court cautioned the jury, and it said, this is my practice, I'm protecting your privacy. And there are numerous cases, including the case that the defendant himself cites, United States versus Thomas, that says where a plausible, non-prejudicial reason is offered, the danger of prejudice is eliminated or, at worst, severely minimized. And we have that right here. In no uncertain terms, the trial court said that. The other thing that I wanted to touch on briefly is that it's just good public policy. We want to encourage juror participation. We want to encourage goodwill. Several of the federal cases, many of them, say that the whole idea of jury duty is that you pluck a jury out of society, the juror comes and serves his or her civic duty, and then disappears back into society. With an anonymous jury, you absolutely accomplish that, because you have a juror who comes up, does his or her job, and then goes back into society without having to answer questions, without having to have their privacy interests mingled with. the idea is inconspicuously fade back into society, and that's exactly what these jurors were able to do. I think I want to touch on the Juror 16 challenge for cause, unless any of your honors have more questions about the anonymous jury. All right, the challenge for cause, the crux of this juror's complaint is not that I'm prejudiced against the defendant. The crux of the complaint was that I don't like or I don't trust cross-examination because when I was cross-examined, I didn't think they got to the truth of the matter. But that's strictly a credibility issue. That's something that we want a juror to look at and to evaluate and to rationally think about when that juror is on the jury and deliberating. It's not a case where Juror 16 said, I can't possibly be fair to the defendant, or I'm 100% in favor of the prosecution. This juror explicitly said, I can be fair to both sides, but I have this issue with cross-examination. That issue with cross-examination is not an issue with the substance of the case so much as with the procedure, that the trial procedure that every attorney employs. We're talking about one that is a trial procedure that she doesn't like, but that's equally applicable to both sides. And anything beyond that is, again, speculative.
Well, I asked Mr. Carberry, the question I'll ask you, is McCrander still good law? Under Ross versus Oklahoma and Martinez Salazar.
I think McCrander is still good law. I would don't necessarily always want it to be good law, but I think it is fine. I think the case here that might prove a very good foil for this particular juror is People versus Merrow out of this court, where we had a juror, if you're not familiar with the case, where the juror repeatedly said, I can't abide drug use. I think it's abhorrent. I'm going to discredit anybody who talks about drug use. And then the trial court didn't rehabilitate her, didn't see if she could be fair regardless of that drug use. And this court reversed, saying that there was no rehabilitation. The juror clearly was biased against drug users, which were predominantly defense witnesses. And so they said that that would have been your prejudice. That juror should have been excluded for cause. Here we have the trial court repeatedly talking with her, getting statements of brutally honest statements, I might add, which is exactly what we want out of the jury selection process, where the juror said, I can be fair. I think I can be fair. I'm not 95% certain that I'm 95% certain that I can be fair. There'd be a nag in the back of my mind, but that's something that I think everybody would have until they're faced with the exact facts. She was saying over and over again that I can be fair. And that's something that this trial court really focused on. The trial court allowed an extended voir dire. He allowed in-chambers examination. There were extra questionnaires. And the trial court himself interviewed several of the prospective jurors in order to make sure that the defendant got an unbiased jury and a fair jury.
Let me ask you this. The last question that the trial court put to this juror went through the presumption of innocence and the necessity of proving the prosecution's case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
It says, would you have the ability to do that? The answer was, I would say yes if the attorney does their job. Now, that's certainly far from being unequivocal. That seems to be saying, well, yes, if the attorney does things the way I want them to do it.
Sure.
So how is that a rehabilitation of the juror's statements that I have problems with the way attorneys cross-examine?
Well, I have two responses to that, and one of them I'm going to punt back to that the trial court's in the best position to understand the prospective juror's answers, and it's harder for this court, based on a cold record, to do it. And with that in mind, I'm going to say that I'm not sure she was talking about the defense attorney so much as, would you take it to the prosecution to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? Can you hold them to that burden? Yes, assuming the prosecuting attorney can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think there's a question of connotation in that question that doesn't necessarily come across in a cold record. And that's one of the reasons that we default to the very high abuse of discretion standard. for these sort of cases and default to the trial court judge. Just to come back, if there are no more questions, I want to close with one thought on the anonymous jury issue, unless there are any other questions about the previous issues. And that's that there's no fundamental right to have jurors identified by name for a panel. That there's a state versus Goodwin out of California says that where if the counsel knows their names, they're just not anonymous. And that the relevant question is, did the defendant have enough information to intelligently exercise his peremptory challenges? Here, the answer is clearly yes. Extended voir dire, numerous questionnaires, in chambers, examination, trial court, individually examining the jurors. I don't think there's any question, but that voir dire guarantees the fundamental right to the unbiased jury, and that voir dire here was beyond the call of duty, so to speak. It was extended specifically to allow that unbiased jury for the defendant. So if there are no further questions, I think I'm going to leave you with a quote directly from United States versus Scarfo, and that's the ideal of dispassionate judgment, and that's precisely what juror anonymity accomplishes. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The trial judge told the jurors, I do it to protect your privacy interests. And the next follow-up in the jurors' minds is, because Mr. Perez is a dangerous man who will harm me. That's the problem. And it can't be harmless error in this case, because the evidence was basically the testimony of CV and the testimony of Mr. Perez. The rest of the evidence was about what Ms. CV seemed like after the fact. That is just a credibility contest. The jurors have to decide. And here we have jurors who were told that we're keeping their names anonymous. That violates federal law. All the cases say that you only do it when there's a real danger to the jurors. Now, I know we're supposed to make arguments that you can say with a straight face, but I don't see how anybody can make an argument that having an anonymous jurors could be a benefit to the defendant. That the jurors would have the courage of their convictions, that's not due process. What happened here is these anonymous jurors had the courage of their convictions, and they convicted this man who very well might be completely innocent. Because really, it was his word against CV's. And Judge Casebolt, I think that you pointed out the essential problem with juror number 16. Nobody rehabilitated her. She said over and over again that she didn't know if she could be fair, and she said at least twice that she had a serious doubt about her ability to be fair.
Mr. Kerber, let me ask this. This is out of the record. This was a question posed by it must have been the district attorney, I'm not sure, but do you all agree, here is the question, do you all agree that if the government fails to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, that you can and will bring back a verdict of not guilty? Juror number 16 answers that question, yes.
All right, one unequivocal answer. Yes, she'd find him guilty, but in a slew of answers where she had serious doubts about her ability to be fair. She did, the trial counsel in this case did an excellent job of making her say the words out of all the case law. This is a juror who had a serious doubt and was very equivocal about her ability to be fair. There is no case that says that a juror can say that in Colorado. And then finally, as to the question about whether McCrander is good law, It is good law in Colorado. The United States courts set a floor to constitutional rights, not a ceiling. And Colorado has always granted greater rights than the federal Constitution. And for those reasons, I'd ask this court to reverse Mr. Perez's conviction and to remand the case for a new trial. Thank you.
Mr. Carberry, I have a comment. You have always done a very good job of zealously representing your clients before this court, and this case is no exception, and you've done a very good job. But I have to raise a sentence with you that you put in your reply brief. It says, perhaps white hoods would help in anonymity, especially in the prosecution of minorities like Mr. Perez. Now, Mr. Carberry, the implication of that sentence in your brief is that the jurors were perhaps racist, and perhaps the judiciary is racist, or perhaps members of the Ku Klux Klan. Statements like that have no place in briefs before this court. My panel members agree with me on this, and I do not want to see that again.
All right, Judge Derry.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.